Welcome back to Compliments to the Chef. I'm your host, Nancy.
And I'm your host, Bits.
And we've got a two-part restaurant wars to talk about.
Wow. It is a twofer.
Episodes 10 and 11 are restaurant wars. So we're going to jump into episode 10, but not before we do some leftovers from this episode 9.
This is the Fellowship of the Ring to the next week, Two Towers. Or if you're a Twilight fan, this is the first finale Twilight movie to the second one.
Or if you're a Wicked fan, this is Wicked Part 1 to Wicked Part 2.
Or if, what other movies did they break in half? Or if you're a Harry Potter fan of the last book, this is Part 1 of the last book.
Or if you're a Mad Men fan, this is season 6A to the season 6B that they did.
All to say, maybe this one's going to suck, but the next week's going to be really good. Because we're just going to fill this one with a lot of hot air.
No, Mad Men never sucked. I need you to take it back.
I know. It didn't. And you know what does suck about Mad Men? And I can't do this for my judgy table because it's not related to food, but that I have to get AMC. Mm. And they know it. They know it. AMC knows it.
AMC knows that they have one piece of content that people are genuinely willing to pay a subscription for, and they are and they're holding it over it. Our heads. They're never giving it up.
They're lords of the admin. Wow. This, okay, we digress, we're in a good place. Also, this is a very fun episode, Nancy. I'm really excited to talk about it because honestly, like, who wouldn't want two episodes for Restaurant Wars?
It's so, and the way they do it is so good. But wait, no, we are getting ahead of ourselves.
We are.
We have leftovers. And I want to start with your leftover of it's Where Are one. They Now? John Tizar, the most hated chef in Dallas.
Yes. So I can't believe I didn't come prepared with this last time. So apologies if you were waiting on this. Funny enough, though, the stars sort of aligned for this to be, you know, the timing, because at the time of recording this, only a day prior, yesterday, some may say, John actually got engaged and announced it on his Instagram.
So
mazel to him. I think the thing that is funny, however, and Top Chef related, which I actually saw on Reddit today, was that somebody posted in the r/Top Chef community. I need to shout out, give proper cred.
Please, we love our Reddit community, by the way.
We love our
Thank
cred.
Thank you to everyone who reposts us on Reddit. We don't know who you are, but we're obsessed with you.
So username Love That's actually dropped a post in the Top Chef community today and says, John Tizar and Katsuji, we all knew Katsuji, are beefing again. So apparently Katsuji dropped a comment on John Tizar's post with his fiance and said, quote, fifth time's a charm, ? And John deleted it.
Yeah. Wait, that's way worse than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, yeah, like that's like kind of mean, but it's funny. Like actually that's what the top comment says.
Wait, adorable that's explicitly ad. Mean. Like I thought it was going to be like something way more benign than that and people reading into it.
Yeah, that it's truly antique beef on our hands.
Yeah, that beef goes back to season 14 All-Stars. Well, it was kind of a pseudo All-Star season. It's also the season that Brooke Williamson won. Go back and listen to our interview with Brooke Williamson. It's incredible.
Do it.
But their beef, for those who don't remember, comes with just like, I think in general, Katsuji and John found each other grating. But John was eventually the reason why Katsuji went home. He wasn't the reason why Katsuji went home, but Katsuji did John a really big favor that took time away from him. And then Katsuji went home for a completely unrelated mistake that same episode. So I think in their like villain origin story lore, Katsuji probably feels like it's John's fault that he went home. But okay, objectively, it was two unrelated incidents.
Okay. Well, that's a good refresher. On the train of thought of beef.
Fifth time's the charm. That's really mean.
So.
And on Instagram, like he didn't even do it in a private
And John deleted
setting.
It though. But now, you know, the internet doesn't forget. So here we are.
That's good.
But anyways, speaking of beef, John, since his time on Top Chef, he's still hanging out in Dallas. He has spread to the coasts, so he's taken the brand, you know, from the left to the right. But
as they say,
he's earned high praise for his restaurant called Knife, which is a steakhouse. He also has two other concepts that are a bit newer: Outer Reef and Knife and Spoon. So Knife and Spoon are a bit of the split the difference between a steakhouse and seafood.
Everyone's doing seafood steakhouses these days.
Yeah, we're back, man. This was like when everybody was doing like steak frites.
Or sushi and steak was a big combo.
Ew.
That was a big combo for a while.
That's like gross. If I'm eating one, I don't want to eat the other.
I also never got...
It's a mindset thing too. At least with like... At least you can get kind of like... yeah, like luxurious isn't the right word, but you could go to a blowout seafood dinner and a blowout steak dinner. I don't – the way that I enjoy sushi is not the way I want to enjoy steak.
Yeah, I mean, and you can do a blowout sushi dinner, but it's just these two cuisines are diametrically opposed.
Yeah, it's like just not decadent in the same way.
Exactly. A steakhouse is about like fat.
Yeah.
And like creamed corn and like indulgence. And sushi is all about refinement, and it can be expensive, don't get me wrong, and it can be like you're leaving just as full.
Right.
But it's just about delicacy.
It's a different decadence. It's different. I want to enjoy them in their own individual rights.
Agreed.
So really, like, as soon as he left Top Chef, he kind of like shifted his focus away from this fine dining situation into really wanting to dial in and being like an authority on steak. So he took on this steakhouse project, this project being Knife, back in 2014, quote, with the caveat that it'd be different from the rest.
Okay.
So what's meant by that?
He's not like other girls.
He does dry aging. So similar to him and Katsuji's beef, this beef is dry aged.
Don't all steakhouses do dry aging?
Yeah, right? Maybe Outback doesn't.
John is a real not like other girls.
He is. I think the bio reads a bit like, you know, writing about myself in the third person. But yeah, so he's since expanded that. He now has restaurants in Orlando. He has a restaurant in California, Laguna Cliffs in Dana Point. I don't know what that is, but it's somewhere near Laguna Beach, maybe.
Maybe. Or another honestly, Laguna. It might not be.
Who knows? It's all Greek to me.
Go off, John Tizar.
Go off, John Tizar. So, yeah, he's still cooking. He's still slinging stuff, and he's engaged. So, congratulations. And
Fifth time's the charm. I'm never getting over that. What if I said that at your wedding?
That's a big number. And not, like, whatever. It's 2024, but...
it's a big number. Anyway, okay. We have two other leftovers to... take care of before we get into this week's episode. So first leftover is we were curious about dates, if dates are stone fruit. The answer is yes. And the article I found said yes. Dates, mangoes, coconuts, green almonds, lychees, and olives are also technically classified as stone fruits, as are mulberries, blackberries, and raspberries. So we learned this last week that raspberries are considered stone fruit. And we are like, excuse me?
Whoa.
And so this article says, wait, some berries are stone fruits? And here's what it says. Botanically speaking, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, a berry is a fleshy fruit with multiple seeds deriving from a single ovary of an individual flower. This category includes cranberries and blueberries, as well as bananas, grapes, tomatoes, and avocados, among others, but does not include mulberries, blackberries, and raspberries.
Wow.
While their name implies that they are berries, mulberries, blackberries, and raspberries are actually aggregate fruits in the drupe or stone fruit family. Each mulberry, raspberry, or blackberry is a drupelet or a cluster of tiny drupes, each of which contains a single seed. Strawberries are also aggregate fruit, but they are, I don't know how to pronounce this word, they're not drupes. A story for another day.
They don't droop. If it don't droop, it's no bueno.
If it don't droop, it ain't a stone fruit. I feel like I need to go back to like kindergarten.
Truly, like something I learned today. That is a today.
Tomatoes are berries. That's crazy. And bananas because it's an aggregate of seeds.
Right.
wild. But honestly, I'm going to learn this and choose to disregard it. Like, mm-hmm. raspberries will always be berries to me. And yeah. you can't tell me otherwise.
Rasp droops.
Okay, our final leftover before we get to the show is Bob Kramer knives. We wanted to look up how much they cost.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, plebe that I am, plebeian, layperson that I am, went to the Bob Kramer website, hoping that I might find just a shop tab and perhaps a nice Shopify e-commerce experience. You would be wrong. It is incredibly difficult to acquire a Bob Kramer knife, and they are not cheap.
Wow.
Okay. Would you like to know how to acquire a Bob Kramer knife? You have to join the Bob Kramer membership club, which is a $1 fee. And once you join, you are given access to the Bob Kramer newsletter, which announces when Bob Kramer knife auctions happen. There is no regularity to these auctions. They can happen at any time in any frequency. So one day you might just get an email in your inbox that tomorrow's the day.
Wow.
Now, how do these auctions work, you might ask? So glad you asked. The auctions are a regular auction. You must become a registered member. And then the starting bid for any knife is $250 with bid increments of $250. So first bid is $250, then it goes up to $500, and so on. The auctions run for 24 hours online. And the average price of a Bob Kramer knife is around $26,000.
Oh, my God.
These knives are no joke.
I thought Padma said it was like $500 on the show.
No.
Oh, it's she said like, starts at.
No. It's like whatever the dollar amount she said, it was like per inch of steel.
Oh my God. I missed that.
And
oh
that was
God.
2012. So yeah. Obviously inflation. Anyway, Micah's going home with a nice piece of hardware is all I have to say.
Yeah. Like,
$26,000.
I was not expecting that. I was really thinking like maybe $5,000.
And the crazy thing, I mean, here's the thing. If you covet a Bob Kramer knife, I guess you like are really attentive and you follow the auctions. And I guess you just make sure that you constantly have a balance in your bank account of $25,000. But like the auctions happen at any point in time. So you just have to be ready to spend that money tomorrow.
Ready for the Kramer.
Crazy. Anyway, okay. I digress. We need to keep our episode short, as my mother says. So let's begin.
Okay. Season 10, episode 10, 10-10 Make-A-Wish. Nancy.
10-10 wins.
What is your amuse-bouche reaction to this?
I love this restaurant we're set up for so many reasons, one of which, Danny Meyer in the house. Are you kidding me?
Yes.
Like, you got the king of opening restaurants to come to your, like, shitty restaurant. Not that Restaurant Wars is shitty, but, like, the scales at which he judges things are very different from Restaurant Wars. But if you could have anyone making a snap judgment as to who should win and who should lose this challenge, it's Danny Meyer.
Yeah.
So already I'm hooked. And then I just loved the format. I'm obsessed. Oh, sorry. We're on Amuse Bouche. I was like, we missed the quick fire. Okay. Amuse Bouche bits. What did you think of this episode?
So since you kind of took the Restaurant Wars route, I'll just give a little tip of the hat to the quick fire, which was also so dumb. It was so dumb, but I loved it in a fun way. It was just dumb. Let's actually just roll right into it because I have to go in on it.
We've got another product placement.
So we got another challenge. Product placement. So
okay,
the
what
challenge,
do you have to say about it?
The challenge today, they had 15 minutes, by the way. I do think maybe my amuse bouche is we got more Wolfgang Puck also.
Thank God.
And he couldn't help but just like crack jokes about how much time 15 minutes was. I mean, obviously like facetiously, but it is true. Like to hear it repeat it over and over, you do realize, wow, 15 minutes is no time at all whatsoever.
At all.
So anyways, the challenge today was sponsored by Canada Dry. It was an immunity challenge. And the chefs – see, this – okay, this to me was the thing that I LOL'd at. They didn't even need to use the Canada Dry. They just had to make a ginger-focused dish.
Yeah. There was a lot that made me LOL about this challenge, that they didn't have to use Canada Dry, although the smart ones did. But that is just like, since when was Canada Dry a sponsor of this show? Like,
I don't know.
Heard of this once? Now tell me, Bits, Canada Dry or ginger ale? Which one are you? Or sorry, Canada Dry or Schweppes?
Oh, Canada Dry.
Yeah, I think I am too.
Yeah. That's what my grandma had in the fridge. So,
yeah, I'm with you. I love ginger ale. Oh my God.
Ginger ale is really a delight. Like, you almost look forward to being kind of under the weather so that you can have a ginger ale because it just hits different.
Like, I know that there's no scientific proof, but like, it really does settle the tummy.
I wish that somebody would have done just ginger ale and saltines. That's it.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Oh, but okay, anyways.
Well, so let's talk about what they made for this quickfire.
Yes. Okay. So which was the craziest sounding one to you? Let's start there.
Okay. Great question. There were a few that were nutso butso to me. Lizzie's watermelon and ginger soup.
Mm.
While it was, you know, highly regarded by Wolfgang, and I was happy to see her come out on top when she had just been on the bottom in such a dramatic way. That one sounded nutso butso to me.
I'm going to go with Josh,
yep,
who did a white chocolate ginger soup. Maybe it's a soup thing.
With peaches
chocolate
and tarragon?
I don't know. I don't know. It's interesting because the critique he got was that it lacked flavor and was underwhelming. So I have to wonder how, just because there was like 400 things in it. And they're all pretty intense flavors.
Yeah. Peaches, yeah, yes. Tarragon is like a beautifully intense flavor.
Yeah, white chocolate is, I mean, it's mild, but it tastes like white chocolate.
I don't
know
if white chocolate soup is like a thing that exists in the world, and he did a play on it.
Let's left over that because I have no clue.
Yeah, can you just make a note of that?
Yeah.
I just was so floored by the thought of doing that. I didn't like the sound of that at all.
Yeah.
Other things that were cuckoo bananas a bit, or not necessarily cuckoo bananas, but of note, Kristen using the CO2 charge not to make a foam but to intensify the flavor
of the ginger was
incredible.
I thought that was I like when things get technical. It makes me realize like how much we don't really see that this season.
We don't see
a lot of like kooky technique like that.
I mean, I think the only person who's bringing it is Kristen. Like, she did a foam. Actually, she does a foam in this episode. And she does a foam in the following episode.
Yeah.
So,
who are even – I mean, obviously Buddha, Blaze. Like, there's certain people that are just like –
Marcel is the fucking king of foam.
Yeah.
He is the godfather of the Top Chef foam.
Godfather of foam.
But we see it a lot in less, it goes in waves. It was definitely really hot in the early seasons of Top Chef.
Right.
By the time we get to season 10 that we're watching, it's still like in the zeitgeist, but way less fashionable. It's sort of like early in Top Chef, it was like early adopters. Now it's very mainstream and almost like gimmicky.
Yeah. So now and then it's like back to basics.
Yeah. And then it really disappears from the lexicon until I would say Buddha. And I think Buddha is part of a vanguard of chefs that's sort of bringing it back in like a less stupid and like frat guy, or not frat guy, like a less Mark Zuckerberg in a zip up hoodie kind of way. And just in like and now let's see what we can do with this. Like, we're all adults here. There are interesting things to be done.
Well put. Well put.
Thank you.
On the other, I guess in the continuing the thread of like smart simplicity, Stefan had a pretty solid performance.
Mm-hmm.
Did an ahi tuna with lemongrass and ginger.
That sounded delicious.
That to me sounded the best. I'm going to be honest, like everything that was sort of like on the cold side sounded interesting to me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Sheldon, unfortunately, like really took a tumble here, making a stir fry.
I believe the word they used was pedestrian, yeah, which is like, ooh,
woof.
I do love stir fry though.
And then, you know, here and there, but we had Brooke take the win. She made a ginger caramel squid. Was super clean flavor, Vietnamese, mm-hmm. inventive, creative. So they were pretty excited on that one.
Yep.
So that means she's moving into a pretty important elimination challenge with immunity.
Huge.
Let's get to the Danny Myers of it because I agree. You know what? I'm not going to stack rank like the judges that we see this season, but there's something so...
Danny Meyer is so elite.
Yeah. There's just distinctly eliteness to him that is...
And you can tell that the chefs are kind of shocked that it's Danny Meyer. Because I think that they're used to having like really prestigious chefs on the show. And like, of course, that comes with a huge amount of intimidation.
Yeah.
But, and I think Brooke really like... hammers this home. Like, Danny Meyer is not a chef, but he is a kingmaker.
Yeah.
And he, like, even if you don't win this challenge, and Brooke is like, I just need to impress Danny Meyer. Like, I don't care if I win, but like, if he can see some potential in me, that's career changing. Like, this is a judge who truly, if he sees something he likes and, you know, sees potential in you, like, could change your life.
It also, it's kind of refreshing because you just like, and not that Tom takes shit at all. You know, all of the judges are like, don't bullshit a bullshitter. But like this guy, you don't even want to try.
No. He can smell, because he's a business guy. He's in the bit, like he makes money. So he can sniff out any bad idea, any like poorly conceived dish, like, or just business idea. He knows it.
He looks like a celebrity too. I know he is kind of a celebrity, but you know what? He's got this like look about him that you just he's pretty magnetic in a kind of interesting way.
Yeah. Also, I want to shout out Danny Meyer's daughter, whose name I actually can't remember, but she is the, I mean, obviously it's a bit Nepo Baby-esque, but I love a food industry Nepo Baby, whatever. She has started what I believe is the best ice cream in New York City, Cafe Panna, which is like leagues above any ice cream I've ever had. It is so delicious. And, you know, she's just like using daddy's skill set to open an ice cream shop, which fucking
that we all need.
If I were Danny Meyer's daughter, I would do exactly the same thing. I would open a really well-branded, excellent ice cream shop. And I'd just live out my days happy as a clam.
Here's to that. What was the preferred flavor?
Well, they have different flavors every single day.
Oh.
But they are so good. I have had like life-changing ice cream scoops from Cafe Panna. There's one that's a passion fruit ice cream with raspberry and chocolate flecks in it. That's really good.
Wild.
They have, oh my God, there's so many good ones.
Well, we'll have to try it.
In my freezer, I have a rainbow cookie one, which is like an almond.
I don't like rainbow cookie, but I respect it.
With bits of rainbow cookie and like raspberry jam. Oh my God. It's so good. Okay, I could wax poetic. But anyway, so we're really far into this and we haven't even talked about the challenge. So Restaurant Wars is a two-parter this season. In episode 10, we have all of the chef testants creating a single dish that represents the concept of the restaurant that they would go on to make in Restaurant Wars. So you're essentially representing yourself with one dish that illustrates the type of restaurant you're going to run for Restaurant Wars. Then there will be two winners of this challenge, each of whom will win $10,000 and will go on to be the executive chefs of the competing restaurants in Restaurant Wars. And one person will go home. Wow.
And they have to cook for 200 people.
Oh, 200 people. Insane.
And they get four sous chefs to help who are basically just past Top Chef contestants from the season, which I love when they – just a quick aside. I love when they do this and they bring back eliminated chefs and then they like fully just give them no voice. Like they no longer have speaking parts. They're just like in the background, quiet.
Yeah. I mean, I bet that they're like pretty well coached by production to essentially be like, you are not getting back on this show.
You are the help.
Well, essentially, because also, like, they've all now gone through Last Chance Kitchen and not won.
Right.
So, and I'm assuming the chefs, maybe they, like, sussed out, like, oh, these are the people who haven't won. Like, maybe they're not allowed to say anything about Last Chance Kitchen.
Oh, maybe. Maybe they're, yeah, I guess they have to kind of be tight-lipped about just stuff going on generally.
But I bet production is like, this is no longer your show. You are there to help. You are not there to offer.
It is people. Interesting, though. Like, I could see some value in having them at least have some talking heads. Like, oh, you know, I thought her ball, like her matzo ball was a little big, or I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, oftentimes when they bring the sous chefs back, it's like for the finale. And we see...
We see a little bit of that, I guess.
Yeah, we see like some collaboration and like some real working with them. But this one, it was like fully just you are robots.
Yeah, they really didn't make it much of a thing. But okay, let's talk about some of these concepts. But before we get into that, and this should speak to the type of person I am, maybe in a way that is unfavorable, but I would be disappointed to win this challenge. I would not want to win this challenge.
I was going to say the exact same thing. We'll get to this with judges table. But like, I would have wanted to perform well, but not win.
Right.
Like not just, I guess, spoiler alert, but like Josh to me is in the perfect position in this challenge where like he impressed Danny Meyer. He cooked a good dish, but he doesn't have to be executive chef.
Yes. And honestly, like if it wasn't for Danny Meyer, I bet that that would have been more of a strategy people took here.
Mm-hmm. Like, well, I wonder if I think a lot of people took this strategy, like
just kind of fly at a lower altitude,
purposefully throw the challenge. But like, and I'm not saying I don't want to call her like I bet Brooke could have won this challenge. She had immunity. She's always done really well with immunity. And like, I'm not saying that she purposefully made her matzo ball too dense or whatever the critique was, but like, I'm sure she had a dish in her back pocket that could have just smoked this challenge.
Perhaps. I do think that her wanting to impress Danny Meyer quite a bit maybe like negates that possibility. But I hear you that definitely there are chefs in the room that are making that calculus. So you are the – let's see. You're the judges. You're walking around the room. Which restaurant here were you going to walk to first?
Great question. I'm looking at – sorry. I know I just went nonverbal, but I'm just looking at my list of all the different restaurants.
You got to like – yeah, you're taking in the signs. You're taking in the smells.
I think Sheldon for sure because I've never had Filipino cuisine and I would trust Sheldon with my life. So I would be really interested to try his food. And it's just so different from everything else there.
Yes.
So that – I think number one would be Sheldon. I will say I was a bit confused by Brooke's – Brooke and Stefan had, like, wild concepts that honestly felt surprisingly half-baked for both of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Right back to you, because my answer was Sheldon, so you have to pick someone else. Don't even try to copy me. Whose restaurant are you going to?
I would go to Lizzie's.
Oh, love that.
Yeah, I would go Northern Italian. I think it's a good way. You know, I'm thinking about any times I've gone to food festivals. You want to just go get your sea legs, get a little something in your tummy to warm you up. And if I can't have Sheldon's,
then I'm going to Lizzie's.
But no, I think it was probably – I would imagine that it could be – fairly reliably solid. I don't it's so of the era, like to put kind of a light on Josie, her home 305, which is, as we all know, because of Pitbull, the Miami area code. I just like can't that was such a moment of the time, like to put like your area code in restaurants.
So true.
New Orleans. Nancy and I both lived in New Orleans. That's where we met, became friends. New Orleans is like very obsessed with putting NOLA or New Orleans or 504 in everything. It's
everything.
Like pretty wild. But yeah, I would start with Lizzie. I totally – let's go back to the point though on that you're making on Stefan and Brooke because I completely agree. I was really shocked about Brooke's choice.
Yes.
It felt like – Yeah.
I don't have bakes. So Brooke's concept is a Jewish restaurant. And so it was like turning, or it's called Unkosher. Which I have no problem.
Yeah, I was gonna say, as the like, as the Jewish person in the room,
I have no problem. I actually don't know if Brooke is Jewish or not. Regardless, like, I'm not upset about a really talented chef making Jewish food. But I do think the name was a bit odd. And I guess I don't understand why you'd want the whole thing about Jewish food is that it's like your bubby's recipes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not good if it's not your bubby's recipes, because a lot of it isn't good. It's just like nostalgic.
Yeah, like matzo ball soup is pretty. It's like chicken noodle soup without anything interesting plus a matzo ball.
Yeah, there are a lot of places like in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, there's a restaurant called Meshuggah, which like is sort of like Argentinian and Jewish food. And all, like in Mexico City, there's one that has like a similar name. Like, there's definitely like takes on Jewish food everywhere. And
mm-hmm.
it's just never really of interest to me.
Yeah.
Because I'm just like, I don't, if I want, if I'm going to get like something akin to matzo ball soup, I'm just going to have matzo ball soup. Like, yeah. I don't need it to be fancy or interesting. It's just a cuisine that I don't think needs the limelight. And maybe I'm a traitor to my people for that, but it's just to me a cuisine that is meant for family and celebrations. And I don't need it in a restaurant setting.
Yeah, it's too old for innovation. It's thousands of years old.
Literally the oldest it could be.
Yeah, so that was...
That wasn't pretty... a very articulate
No, I get it. I totally get what you're saying. It's like... you like it for the qualities that having a fine dining chef kind of negates.
Yeah, exactly. But so her dish, by the way, at Unkosher... was matzo ball soup with duck confit and mushrooms. Like, matzo ball soup is a perfect food. It does not need duck confit and mushrooms.
Yeah.
Because it's also just something, like, every culture has a version of matzo ball soup. Like, it's like in the South, it's chicken and dumplings. It's literally matzo ball soup.
Right.
And so when you add duck confit to it, it's just no longer matzo ball soup, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, like, what is matzo ball soup? It's chicken.
It's broth, chicken noodle right? soup, chicken meat.
Yeah.
But the noodle is a giant ball.
Right. But all the noodles got together.
Exactly. Okay, let's move on from Brooke.
Interesting. On the Stefan train, that one also weird.
Out of nowhere, he likes Thai food?
I thought that that was that was an expression he was saying, like, oh, it's Bangkok via Munich. Like, I thought he was describing it that way. And then when I realized it was the name of the restaurant, I was like, what? Yeah, so his Stefan was just, like, makes, not even connected. Like, there were literally different bites.
Yeah. So he makes a spicy Thai lobster bisque, which sounds good, and then a banana lollipop. So, yeah, talk about what the judges said about it.
Well, they first asked, like, is this the same lollipop we had the last time you were on this show? He was like, oh, kind of. It didn't really work. The lollipop, it was very visually interesting and arresting. You know, it's got the mm-hmm. dry ice effect with the smoke coming off of it. But I think the meta critique was that he had a concept and this didn't reflect it at all. Like, the food that we got did not reflect the concept. I don't know how you reflect the concept. Apparently there's a way that you can do that, but he didn't do it.
Yeah, it felt like a very... thinly made association between these cuisines. Like, I don't know. Nothing about it landed or made sense to me.
Yeah.
But let's talk about some of the other unfortunate flops in the group. So we have Micah, who is doing a raw food concept. And he essentially made a plate that was a medley of raw fish with shiso leaves, the hardest word to say in the English language, and some sort of like sauce.
He had salmon, snapper, hamachi, squid, scallop, and mackerel. He had just like a bunch of fish. And honestly, for me, if I would love to like order that from a takeout sushi spot and just be like, oh, nice. Like, It's just a platter.
It's just a sashimi platter.
Yeah. I don't know what he was thinking. And it was interesting, the talking heads, that like nobody else did either.
Did you catch the moment where Tom like openly grimaced when Micah was... So Micah is saying like, you know, raw food is so great. And he's like, and ladies love to watch their figure.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Tom is like, he goes...
Yeah.
Like, he
Gail
made a
was
real,
not
like,
loving that either.
Like neck pull. It just was... There's a way to say food is healthy without saying like women want to be skinny.
I mean, I'll give him credit. Like he was saying it in the context of like, I'm a chef in Beverly Hills, and Beverly Hills, like this is what people want to eat there. I have some sympathy for that. I still think it was a bad idea to do that.
Well, this whole challenge, like you're pitching to the number one restaurateur in the world. So like, you got to know how to present and what your narrative is and what
story
you're
telling.
Yeah,
that's very true.
Like, that is a huge part of the challenge. It's not just the dish you make. And I think both his dish was bad and the story he was telling was bad.
That's a great point.
To your point, like, there is a way – I'm sure there was a winning raw food idea that he could have done.
Yeah.
But he just – he fell short.
Yeah, I wish that he could have heard Danny Meyer's feedback before he put it all together, because he says something really interesting, which is like, we already have sushi as context.
Yes.
And if this isn't adding something to the dialogue, then what's the point of it? Why do we need it? And it's, oh, what a great question to ask, and one that he probably should have asked before this challenge.
It's kind of like, I feel like omakase and hand roll bars are like adding to the dialogue of sushi.
Mm-hmm.
Up until like those sort of came into the cultural lexicon like a few years ago, sushi was sushi, and there was really good sushi,
right?
And there was like crappy sushi. But Danny Meyer's right, like, we have the basis. So if you're gonna do something that's like raw fish, it has to be different, and it has to be like a fully baked concept in and of itself. But okay, moving on. So you mentioned that you would want to go to Lizzie's Northern Italian Cuisine restaurant.
I did.
She was saying that in Northern Italy, where it sort of borders the Alps, the food is a lot less familiar than like the classic pasta and red sauce that Americans know.
Mm-hmm.
She makes a dish, I keep pronouncing it correctly, called a canaderli. It kind of looked like a matzo ball, if you ask me.
Yeah.
Fonduta. But you said that you want to eat there. So tell us about what you thought.
Oh, I like a creamy pasta. I chose it less on the bite and more on the restaurant itself.
Mm. Okay. Interestingly, if I had to choose based on the bite more than the restaurant, I would pick Kristen's. I don't always jump to French food. I mean, French food is incredible. Do
classic
not get
French
me wrong.
With a twist.
It is not my, like, if I'm given a choice of a bunch of cuisines, French is usually not my top choice.
I agree.
Kristen's dish had me thinking, like, I want to try this restaurant.
I want that. Yeah, hers sounded sick. But on the Lizzie thing, it was super heavy. It felt like very congealed on the top of it. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a hit. It wasn't like the biggest dud of the night, but I guess kind of it technically was a dud, but it was a dump dud. But let's flip and let's talk about some. Well
hold up. Actually,
oh,
let's
Josie
let's,
also
yeah.
didn't do well.
I was gonna say, let's round out the duds with Josie. Wow, we're being assholes.
Well, everybody's done pretty well up to this point, so now we're cashing in.
Okay, talk to us about Josie.
She did a puerco asado black bean situation, best I can remember. Again, we have an issue with plating. She's like talking and yapping while she's plating the dish, so that was like pretty uncomfortable to watch. what was the quote? Okay, I'm needing to remember the context, but I wrote down this quote that Tom said, quote, hopefully you can get it closer to our plate. It was something in context of like it being like a Miami, like,
yes. Like, she's like, I want to feel close to home. He's like, maybe you can get it close to my plate.
Yeah. Yes, that was what it was. Damn, some zingers this season, honestly.
Yeah, Josie just doing the same song and dance to try to make up for the fact that her food was subpar. They said it was almost inedible.
Woof.
Woof. But yeah, that's really all we need to spend on Josie. Let's talk about our top performers. Kristen, because we already mentioned her dish. Kristen made a tortellini, or a French contemporary onsen egg with camembert and radishes, and I think dried apricot.
Yeah, the radish sounded so interesting.
This dish sounded really good.
Pop it in.
I wanted to eat it. And it had a foam.
She's Ms. Foam.
But so Gail pointed this out, and I think that's something that is very true to Kristen, is they said, you know, what's the aesthetic of your restaurant? And Kristen was like, I like formal dining. And to say that in this moment where everyone was going more as, this is essentially just repeating Gail, the lovely Gail Simmons, verbatim. Everyone's going for these rustic, homemade, accessible concepts. And Kristen's like, nope, I want to make something that you can't even conceive of in your own layperson mind. Like, I want to elevate the discourse and have a formal dining experience.
In your tiny little
brain. And
that
really stood out to the judges. Yeah.
Yes. And like, thank you. Thank you for taking that route.
Mm-hmm.
Not this rustic shit
that we were subject to for like 10 years.
Rustic. No, hers looked amazing. Josh kind of turns it around from the quick fire. He, speaking of kind of more rustic, mm-hmm. his was a neighborhood bistro named after his grandfather, I believe.
Yep.
Bistro George.
Bistro George.
So we did the sear eye of ribeye with cauliflower puree and mushroom red wine sauce.
This dish sounded very boring to me. Like, I'm sure it was delicious. I would happily eat it.
Yeah.
But it was very uninteresting.
Yeah, I agree. It conveyed the vision, which I'm like, I guess bistro food is kind of boring. Like, it is just that.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was sweet. He said he would buy a vacation for his wife. Yeah. They're talking about like, oh, you know, what do you get? What would you do with the money that you want? Because each mm-hmm. winner gets 10K. I forget if we mentioned that. Not yep. that it matters. And then the last kind of topsy-wopsy was Sheldon.
Shout out Sheldon, our favorite guy.
Happy birthday.
So his concept was Urbano, which was his grandfather's name as well. And it's modern Filipino food. He made a sour tamarind soup with pork, shrimp, and fish. I love tamarind.
Delish. I had that a lot in Costa Rica.
Yeah. It's a delicious flavor. And again, clearly the judges really loved this dish because at judges' table in the top three, we have Kristen, Josh, and Sheldon. As we said, Josh performed very well but did not take the cake. Instead, Sheldon took the birthday cake. By the way, Sheldon turning 30 on this show is crazy.
Oh, wow.
Young. Think of how much this man accomplished before he turned 30.
It's incredible.
I didn't even start a podcast before I turned 30.
But you're doing it now.
Doing it now. That's all that matters. It's never too late. But yeah, so Sheldon and Kristen win, and they are going to be the executive chefs going into the following week, which is really exciting. They'll be facing off. Happy birthday, Sheldon, $10,000. And then they are told, okay, talk to me about what happens in the stew room after Kristen and Sheldon win.
Oh, this was a dirty twist.
Dirty twist.
Dirty. Okay, so these two get tapped as the executive chefs. They have to then go back into the stew room and pick their team from the remaining chefs. So there's an even number of chefs prior to elimination, which means that they need to select their teams before they know who's going to get eliminated. So we naturally end up with a bit of a boys versus girls. So Kristen picks Josie. Well, she picks the women. Brooke, Lizzie, Josie. And Sheldon picks the gentlemen, Stefan, Josh, and Micah. So as of right now, we have two teams of four. However, Micah, Josie, Lizzie go in on the bottom. So there is a 67% chance that someone from Kristen's team is going to be going home. But what do we find? But Micah ends up leaving for mm-hmm. his raw concept. And yep.
Yeesh.
Can we talk about the choices here? Like
the team choices?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it.
Like, I was pretty shocked that Kristen picked Josie.
Me too. Because this, I'm going to maybe come off sounding like an asshole. But oftentimes, like, the poor performers in the competition are still pretty solid when it comes to, like, mise en place. You know, because you can be an incredible chef and not be good at Top Chef.
Yeah.
We've seen it time and time again. And oftentimes, the people who are sort of struggling with the competition aspect can still perform in a restaurant setting as a sous chef, essentially. But Josie does not give any indication at any point this season that she'd be willing to take herself out of anything to just be a sous chef. And so yeah. I would have never risked it on Josie.
Well, even watching her plating stuff at the two, like, large-scale event challenges and yeah. just being like, okay, like, time is an issue with her, which, like, spoiler alert, like, that kind of is the issue next episode.
And also her personality is a bit of an issue for people. Like, she yeah. is not a quiet presence in the kitchen. And to me, Kristen is, like, so the polar opposite of that.
Yeah.
And likes decorum and likes order. And like, I was so surprised.
And it seems obvious that, you know, she picks Brooke. That was, like, kind of the no-brainer.
Obvious first pick.
And then Stefan was going to be her obvious second choice, but right. he gets taken by Sheldon. And so at that point, you have Micah, Josie, Josh, Lizzie.
I would have picked literally anyone but Josie.
Yeah. I mean, it was between Micah and Josie. And
but
so
I would have taken Micah.
I know. But I wonder if she just really – I wonder if part of her was like, I think Micah's going home.
Yeah. I mean, I would not have put my money on Micah going home.
Yeah, I wouldn't have either.
At all. Like, yeah, his dish wasn't inventive and, like, it didn't blow anyone away. But Josie's was inedible.
Yeah. Well,
and she had a habit of, you know, being on the bottom. But as we know, Top Chef is not cumulative. So we have Micah going home at Judge's table. And next week we have Kristen's concept going against Sheldon's concept. Kristen has the advantage of an extra person in the kitchen. And let's see how that plays out. We'll see. It's a great episode, but we have reached the end of episode 10. And why don't we wrap it up with a few of our favorite segments? So, Bits, Micah's raw fish platter, would you eat that?
Yeah, for sure.
There's some shellfish in there, so I don't know. I'm going to be honest. Right. The whole thing didn't look appealing to me. I actually don't know that I would eat that. Not because
Well, nobody
I don't like
called it dubious, so.
That is I'd true. Okay, fine. I still wouldn't. That's your opinion. But let's talk about where are they now. So Micah, at the time of filming, was the executive chef at the Standard Hotels. Ironically, Kristen Kish went on to marry a woman who was, like, the executive chef of the Standard Hotels, but not Micah. But that's a story for another day. He then went on to be the executive chef at the Ace Hotels. He now is the owner of Iron Catering Crew in Orange County, California. And he is a private chef.
Rock on. I think I'd like being a private chef. I bet that's, like, a pretty sick gig.
Yeah, especially if you get, like, good clients. And yeah. Both in that, like, maybe they have cool destinations that you go to with them and they're just nice.
Yes.
I think that's a nice lifestyle. Maybe one day we'll talk to a private chef. Who knows? But in the meantime, Bits, I think it's time for everyone's favorite segment.
Judgy table. I have one, and I'm
okay,
ready
good.
To rip.
Let me get my timer. Okay, Bits. Your judgy table starts now.
Restaurant names with ampersands in them.
Okay, Richard Blaze.
Spoon and knife. Knife and spoon, whatever John Tizar's is. Cork and fork. We have one of those where I'm from in Pennsylvania. I don't think time. I think time and tide is actually just the word and, so I'll let that slide. But you know who you are. You know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Salt and straw. Like, stop. Pick one word. Pick a person. Don't put two words together for that, like, you know, stomp, clap, Edward and the Magnetic Sharps or whatever, like era stuff. It's like gives me the ick when just – I hate that. I absolutely hate that trend. That actually is something I really hate. I'm surprised I haven't complained about it sooner. That's it. That's my judgy table.
I love that. I mean, it was such a moment.
Ugh.
To have the fucking ampersand in your restaurant. And it, like, it was seen as like so sophisticated. And it's like you're literally just – these are two disparate contents.
Hale and Hearty. Like,
oh, don't fuck with Hale and Hearty soups. Hale and Hearty, first off, is and, not ampersand. And
okay,
second,
okay.
Hale and Hearty is a New York institution that has nothing to do with the very cringy millennial ampersand movement.
It was here before it.
I will defend Hale and Hearty.
Okay, that's fair.
And Hale and Hearty actually closed and very recently, like I'm talking last month, reopened in a new iteration. I don't know the name of it. It's not an and. But anyway, Hale and Hearty I would die for.
Love it. Shout out Hale and Hearty.
Okay, my turn. Nancy, your judgy table starts now. Banana desserts are fucking disgusting. I need to just say that I do love bananas. I like to eat a banana for breakfast. I think it's nice. Banana desserts, like banana pudding, literally like banana cream pie, this banana lollipop, stay away from me. It always tastes artificial. It's just like, it turns my stomach. It is not a flavor that belongs in dessert. I do not like to eat breakfast foods late at night, and I put bananas in that category. And I think that bananas should stay out of dessert. I've never had a banana dessert I liked. I don't like banana pancakes. On that note, I like a raspberry pancake, I like a blueberry pancake, I like a chocolate chip pancake. I don't like banana pancakes. So Jack Johnson, take your banana pancakes and shove it up your ass. I'm done.
Nancy, I feel like I need to call you out on one banana dessert that you love. What? Diana's bananas.
Oh.
Which are chocolate covered frozen bananas, if anybody's never had them.
Et tu, Brute. I do love Diana's bananas. Okay.
They're really good if you've not had them.
They're delicious. We are not getting paid to say this. Diana's bananas are the best dessert
in the world.
Okay, dude. You raise an excellent point. I don't really have a good defense. I need to think about it. But chocolate-covered fruit, I don't know. It's like its
own becomes
thing.
A different – maybe it changes the chemical constitution of it. Yeah,
like a warmed-up banana, like Bananas Foster. Ugh, no, thank you. I don't need a flambé. I just need it to stay flambé away from me.
Flambéed away.
Anyway, okay, so that brings us to the end of our coverage of Restaurant Wars Part 1. We will see you next week for Restaurant Wars Part 2.
Bye-bye.
Bye.